You're listening to Driven by Insight. Join Willie Walker, Walker & Dunlop's chairman and CEO, as we bring you fresh perspectives about leadership, business, the economy, and commercial real estate. Willie hosts a diverse network of leaders as they share wisdom that cuts across industry lines. His guests are experts in their fields, from leading economists and CEOs to Harvard and Yale professors and everything in between. Our one goal is simple: providing you with unique insights, unparalleled data, and real-time market analyses.
What an honor. First of all, thank you everyone for being here. I was going on the set at the New York Stock Exchange for CNBC this morning and walked over to David Faber, who was doing my interview, and he said, "What are you doing in New York?" I said, "I'm leaving here and I'm going up to interview Gloria Steinem." And his jaw literally dropped. He was like, "Wow, that's so cool." I was like, "Yeah." I know you'll get a lot more out of Gloria this morning than CNBC got out of me on live television an hour ago. So Gloria, first of all, thank you. And thank you, Ted Patch, for having it that your aunt is here. As I was doing research on you, there was a recent Esquire magazine article that said, "What distinguished her then is what distinguishes her now. She's engaged. She's not curating an image. She is not interested in legacy. Her most valuable resource is time. And when she gives it, as she often does, it's because she genuinely cares." So for all of us here gathered for this event, thank you, because you taking the time means that you care about what we're doing, and we're very, very appreciative. The other thing that I've heard you talk about, Gloria, is circles. And that when you meet with people, you like to put everyone in a circle so everyone feels like they're part of the conversation. So to the degree that we all feel like we are in this circle here, I just thought that as I was reading how you bring people and sit down with them and talk to them, you create the circle. And so we're hopefully all in a circle. I'll start with my first question. Did you watch Law & Order last night as you were heading to bed?
No,
I thought that's what you did almost every night, was you watch Law & Order.
It's true. I am kind of hooked on Law & Order, right, yes. But no, I confess that I didn't. I was watching Dance Moms. Have you ever seen Dance Moms? Well, it's young women mainly, some young men too, who want to be professional dancers. And it's the story of their lives and their trials and their leader who runs the studio. And because when I was growing up in Toledo, I was taking dancing lessons, and I thought that this was the one thing that was going to get me out of Toledo. And not very realistic,
right?
But it still has that pull of adventure, and you know, it's just going to take you into another world.
So you moved from Toledo to Washington, D.C., and did a year of high school, and then on to Smith College. You just told me before we came on that your sister had gone there, and that's what brought you to Smith. As I was thinking about that, did you go to Smith on a scholarship? How did you afford Smith, given the way you grew up in Ohio and your father leaving when you were 10 and having your mother take care of you until you went to live with your sister?
I think the first year I was not on a scholarship because my mother had actually sold our ancient, terrible house in Toledo in order to finance my way into Smith. And then later on, I did get, but also it was way less expensive than college has become. Hugely, hugely more expensive. And I have to say for Smith that it was a good thing, you know, socially speaking, that if you were on a scholarship. And if you weren't on a scholarship, you were on a daddy ship, which was kind of looked down upon in a way.
After Smith, you came to New York, and I've heard you talk about seeing a woman walking down the street in Manhattan who was dressed in an Australian coat, and you looked at her and said, "That's the first free woman I've seen." Mm-hmm. What captured you?
It's so interesting that you found that. That's true. She was an artist whose name I may come back to me before, really. And I was across the street from her, and She had no purse, which struck me as freedom.
Right.
She had on a kind of big old coat that was flying out behind her. And I thought, this is the first free woman I've ever seen. And I never forgot her.
She talked to her?
No. She was across the street. And only later on did I understand who she was. She was an artist.
And what was it at that moment when you saw that first free woman in your view that said to you, I need to do something along these lines. I need to take what that made me feel like and make more women free.
Well, I don't know if I thought about it then as a movement, but there was still in my era the idea that you didn't find your own identity, you married your identity. And that was very strong in this. We're talking about the 1950s, okay, which was, you know, a very, very conservative time when people were consciously trying to go back to the old way, because after World War II, that seemed much safer. And my classmates, the shine of engagement rings as people raised their hands in class was blinding. Everybody was engaged. I was engaged too, right? And to a very good person and somebody I continued to know all of my life. But it just seemed as if you made this one decision, you didn't have any other decisions to make after that. So instead, there was a small scholarship that somebody had left at Smith to go to India.
All right.
So I went to India instead. I don't know how to explain this exactly. But my mother and both my grandmothers had been theosophists, which is a philosophy which leans heavily towards India. So I had some familiarity with India. And I just got on a ship and left. You know, I mean, it's amazing what we do in our youth, right?
Theosophists believe in reincarnation, correct?
Yes.
Do you?
I'm open to it, but I don't pretend that I know. Right.
You have, just speaking of age and reincarnation, you have a pretty significant birthday coming up at the end of this month.
Shocking. We're talking shocking, right.
My friend David Faber was bemoaning the fact that he turned 60 on Thursday. And I said, you look great. She's turning 90 in 2 weeks.
I did my homework because I tried to find online the oldest woman in the world. And I did find...
118, right?
No, I found a woman in the Himalayas who says she's 130.
Really?
Just saying.
I literally was invited 2 days ago to go to India to meet the Dalai Lama in 3 weeks. And maybe I can go track her down while I'm over there. So talk to me for a moment about the rally when you said, I have. When you were talking about abortion rights.
Yeah.
Right. And you were giving the speech and you were talking generally about the right to choose. And then you inserted into the speech, I have. As you thought about, if you will, coming out with that in that day and age, did you say it because you just wanted to be honest? Did you say it because you needed that from a leader standpoint to, if you will, put your own personal story into the broader narrative?
No, I think I said it because at the time, one in three American women had an abortion at some time in their life. And it just seemed crazy that this was not recognized. Also, I think by that time I had visited Africa and discovered, sitting with women in the middle of the Kalahari Desert, that, and they were showing me the herbs they used to facilitate birth, that literally the herbs that were growing, right? The herbs they used to support effacients. So I suddenly realized, wait a minute, this has always been true. It has always been sometimes necessary and important for women, to women especially, to regulate birth. And why have we allowed various religions or whatever, you know, to tell us otherwise? It just seemed totally, totally illogical. And I remember then I was also speaking with a woman named Florence Kennedy, you know, who this wonderful, outrageous civil rights lawyer was. And she always used to say, if men can get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrilege.
Walker & Dunlop, one of the largest commercial real estate and advisory firms in the country. You start the communities. Our ideas and capital make them possible. And tune in to the Walker Webcast, hosted by CEO Willie Walker, for exclusive insights on commercial real estate.
You dedicated My Life on the Road to Dr. John Sharp. And when Dr. John Sharp was the doctor who performed that abortion illegally in
1957.
And you write that he said two things to you: don't tell anyone my name, and live your life.
And do what you want to do.
And do what you want with your life.
What a wonderful man, right? And I was living in London, working as a waitress, trying to wait until I got a visa to go to India, where my fellowship was. I didn't know anybody much, you know, maybe a couple of people. I found his name in the phone book, and he was just this enormously wise, kind person who came along at a crucial moment. Which I hope we can do for each other. People turn to us in a moment of need. I hope we can do that too.
Had anyone else up until then, Gloria, given you that type of advice? In other words, was what he said that day of do with your life what you want to do, had anyone else, had your mother, your father said something of that nature to you, or anyone else?
Well, I have to say for my parents that they didn't say otherwise. You know, they didn't tell me that I had to lead a certain kind of life. But they were not having such an easy time themselves. My father had 2 points of pride. He never wore a hat, which it's his generation. Men were supposed to wear hats. And he never had a job. Okay. And he had a little summer resort in southern Michigan, and like a dance pavilion where you could dance over the water. And in the wintertime, since he didn't like the cold weather, he would put us into a house trailer, me, my sister, the dog, my mother, you know, and then we would go to Florida or California. Therefore, I didn't go to school. But I was reading all the time in it. I loved to read. I was in love with Louisa May Alcott, I thought, right? And my mother used to say to me, why don't you look out the window? You know, this, and I would say, but I looked an hour ago.
When you, after giving that speech where you said, I have, there's a quote which is, choose between giving birth to someone else and giving birth to ourselves. Why do you think certain women react poorly to that statement? But why do you think certain people in society react poorly to that statement? Is it threatening?
I can't be sure. I mean, I don't know what's in their hearts when they say that, but I think that various institutions in our lives have tried to make birth giving more important than personhood for women. religions have sometimes done that. Although I'm not sure we know the truth of it exactly, because the Catholic Church actually allowed you to abort a male fetus less time than a female fetus. They wrongly thought that you knew by when the fetus quickened.
Right.
So, you know, abortion had been allowed, and it was only Napoleon III who made a deal with the Pope to declare abortion a mortal sin because he wanted more people for his armies. It isn't as if it has come down to us necessarily exactly as it happened, but it just seems to me the basis of democracy. Either we get to make decisions, men and women, over our own physical selves, or what good is democracy to us?
I've heard you talk about democracy, and you say democracy isn't actually real, it's more of a hope. So as you talk about democracy, I thought, particularly given President Obama's comments about his whole, I mean, the image of Obama, I believe we all sit there and say that is the definition of hope as it relates
to
that.
It is great. Thank you for playing that. We need him, right? Yeah.
How was that? That must have been really amazing.
Yes. No, it really was.
Absolutely. Up there as far as one of those life events?
Yes.
Anything else up there with that?
Here, I'm sitting here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. That's really good, really quick, but wrong. But I mean, as you think back on it, I mean, you've done so much. You've seen so many people. You've traveled the world. By the way, the title of your final book, of your life on the road, is that more towards your first 20 years of getting in the van with your father and your mother and packing off, of being life on the road, or is that for the latter 70 of traveling the world and doing everything?
Yeah, it's more for traveling on my own, I think, because when the women's movement, as we think of it now, was really beginning, there was vast interest and not a lot of support. So I, together with a fearless woman named Florence Kennedy, wonderful human being, African-American woman, lawyer, I don't even know, look her up, you'll be totally knocked out. She was going around to speak, and she suggested that I go with her, because that meant if we were representing each different group, in a sense, not that we're different, but anyway, we would attract a more representative audience. So I learned that I didn't die, which I thought I would if I spoke in public. Now, don't you? Doesn't that happen to you? You lose all your saliva.
Yeah.
Each tooth gets a little Angora sweater. You can't think what's coming next, right? Okay. I definitely had that.
You also said earlier that when you get done public speaking, you always go back through it and say, what didn't I say that I wanted to say?
Right. Yeah, I always second guess myself, right?
Well, before I continue on my list of questions, because I'm driving the conversation here, what's the one thing you want to make sure gets said here in front of this group?
No, it's not like I predetermine it. It's like it's what comes up, and then you think, oh yeah, issues that are actually bad.
As you, in reading a lot about you, self-esteem is something that you spend a lot of time looking at, focusing on. And I think you said that women take out a lack of self-esteem on themselves, men take out a lack of self-esteem on others. Talk for a moment about the difference in the genders and women as you fought for women's rights, how important that sense of self-esteem is for women to do what they want.
Well, it's not like it's some evil plot. It's just that there are gender roles, and there used to be much more than there are now. And so the idea of self-esteem was adjusted to the gender roles. So for men, self-esteem had to do with accomplishment outside the home, with earning, with having authority, with, you know, however it was phrased. And for women, it had to do with marriage, children, the house itself, you know, all of the things that, say, Betty Friedan in her important book was trying to say, wait a minute, you know, we're all whole people. We all have ways that we want to show our worth.
As you look at self-esteem, you delineate between core self-esteem and situational self-esteem.
It's, and this guy has done all this research. When I'm losing my memory, I'm calling you up.
Anytime, Gloria, anytime. I will take that phone call. But as you think about core, I thought it was fascinating the way you analyzed these two things, because to summarize what I took away from your writing on this is that if you're, as a child, if you don't gain core self-esteem, your parents look beyond you, or you're constantly compared to other people, that leaves sort of a gap in your own core self-esteem, which in many instances for men sets them up to go try and find situational self-esteem, which is how much money can I make? What kind of a car do I buy? And that gets you on sort of this treadmill of this never-ending seek for situational self-esteem to try and fill in on the core. But if you don't have the core, the situation will never fill it. Fair summary?
Absolutely. And it is gendered. It is affected also by race, which it should not be, obviously. We are intrinsically worthwhile. You know, each person here is a unique miracle who could never have happened before and could never happen again. And we share human qualities. We have unique talents. I mean, but because of racism, because of and bias about males and females, because of economic class, we don't necessarily know that. We don't necessarily know that we are, or grow up anyway, knowing that we are each a unique.
That voice that you just used to explain that to us, when did you find that voice? What you just did with my question, to take it and say it in the way that you said it, is what made you the person that you are. When did you find that voice?
I don't know. I mean, I think we always have a voice in our heads, right? Even if we don't feel like we can yet say it. I don't know. I mean, something, I think I was lucky because something allowed me to have a sense of fairness. Which easily, I mean, I could have grown up in a way that did not. I remember, I don't know if this is relevant or not, but I remember being totally in love with Louisa May Alcott in Little Women. And she had that sense of fairness and involvement in the revolution and her own life. And, you know, so I wonder as children if we don't kind of have that. You know, there have been experiments where they put two babies together and the babies, if one has a milk bottle and the other doesn't, and one baby will share it with the other baby. Then we are social animals.
That's for sure. But certain people have a gift for expressing ideas and conveying thoughts in a unique way. And as I think about your career and what made you the person that you are, it was that gift of being able to take an idea that I just gave you and then, if you will, translate it into something that is so compelling for everyone in the room to hear.
I don't know, but I hope we've recorded this so I can listen to it.
We are recording it. Winding the clock back, what gave you the impetus or the desire to start Ms. Magazine?
I had been a freelance writer living in New York, making a living by writing for Esquire and a variety of magazines. And then also we together started New York Magazine. So I realized it was possible to start a magazine. And I could see that the women's magazines, with all the goodwill of the women who were working there, were still restricted by advertising, and because they had to produce articles that complemented the ad categories that they were seeking. So it meant buying particular products, raising children. You know, it was very, very gendered, with maybe one little article, dropped in there, to get you to buy the catalog. Essentially, it was a catalog of products. So I realized that it wasn't the fault at all of the women who worked there. It was the economic structure that they were working in, and that we could start a magazine without that. You know, if we were willing to take lower salaries, and eventually we became a foundation so we could raise money that way. I don't know, if we could just have a different kind of economic structure, we could write about women's concerns and also invite women from other countries so their voices were there. And magazines were pretty racially divided then too. There were magazines, there was Ebony, there were magazines for Black writers and readers and so on, and so-called white magazines. And the advertising world was structured that way too, as to who you saw driving the car in the car ad. So.
And you ended up having to sell Ms. And in hearing you talk about that, one of the things that sort of angered you was that there was you had the readership, but you couldn't get the advertising to match up to go after that demographic. And it was that, to exactly that point you were just saying, that there was sort of an economic disconnect. You had the readers, you just couldn't get the advertisers.
Yeah, well, I used to go to Detroit, for instance. We used to go to try to get car ads.
All right.
And the car manufacturers would say, okay, providing you show a woman driving this car or a man driving another car, because it demeans this expensive car that a woman can drive it. You can't make this stuff up, right? Okay. And it was just so much trouble that we eventually became a foundation, a 501c3, so that we could produce the magazine and raise money in additional ways.
There's a lot of talk right now about ChatGPT, the artificial intelligence company that was set up as a nonprofit and now has this massive valuation of $800 billion or something like that. And there's a big dispute going on with Elon Musk about the original purpose of setting up ChatGPT as a nonprofit to be a nonprofit. And then now it is turning into this very significant for-profit enterprise. Talking about—
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Did you know that? Whose side should we be on?
Whose side should we be on that one? I think the issue there is that Elon Musk is unlikely waging this fight because he thinks that he's entitled to money. He's got a lot of money. He doesn't need more money. I think he thinks that Sam Altman, who started the company, is not being true to the original mission of it, to set it up as a nonprofit and keep it as a nonprofit. But the final thing I'd say on that is Elon Musk's desire to make more money, though, he just went back for another pay package from Tesla that is just outrageous. And you're sitting there going, you're the richest man, or arguably one of the richest men on the face of the planet, and you're still going for another incremental dollar. So that actually leads me to my question to you. You have talked about going up to the Harvard Business School and teaching a course on how much is too much money. Talk about why you think that course needs to be taught at the Harvard Business School.
Well, you know, what's the point? I mean, is it the point is to be able to be safe, use our talents, take care of our relatives, have children if we want to. And but at a certain level, it just gets to be meaningless, just utterly, utterly meaningless. And also, how can you have that much money and walk around and look at people begging in the street, which we do here in New York and in other rich American cities, and find that that's okay? It's just not interesting. It's much more interesting to help somebody and see their talents and see them grow and see it's way more interesting than numbers in your bank account.
There you go again. That gift she has. She takes an idea and just says it in such a compelling
is
way.
That crazy? No, I don't think that's
so. You said have a family if you so desire to have a family. You didn't have children. Is that a regret?
No, not for a realist. I used to try to get myself to regret it because I thought I was supposed to. but I think that's probably for a series of reasons that may be somewhat different. For instance, when I was growing up, my mother was not well. My parents divorced when I was about 9 or something. And so I was looking after my mother. And I noticed that in people whose parents had been invalids or alcoholics or for some reason as children, you know, we've been looking after grownups, that you don't want to do that again. It's not fair, because a little person looking after a big person is not like having children, but it does affect you.
You mentioned earlier that you were engaged early and then you decided to wait until your late 60s to get married to David Bale.
Yeah, we didn't wait to get, we never would have got married except that he'd been born in South Africa and he was about to be deported. I mean, there was no...
I hadn't heard that part of the story.
I mean, there was, why, you know, at that advanced age, why did we need to, we didn't, you know. I mean, we loved each other. We were together. We didn't have to get married. However, it did turn out to be very important because when he was very ill and in the hospital for a very long time, I could legally make decisions that I otherwise would have maybe had a harder time with.
What's it like to have Batman as a stepson? So to anyone who doesn't know, Christian Bale, her late husband's son, is an actor and played Batman in the last 3 Batman films.
Yes, but he's a much better actor than him.
Than Batman.
I mean, he's a great character actor. He's not just he's able to be a leading man, but he is a totally, he can do absolutely anything. No, by the time I met him, he was grown up. He had, was with the woman he then later married. It was just like having a bonus friend. He's a, you know, a really good, smart, talented guy who's secretly shy, which I think is true of actors often. They have to become someone else.
Talking about true friends, talk for a moment about Wilma Mankiller and your friendship with her.
You know Wilma Mankiller, the chief of Cherokee Nation, right? It's such a loss when I think about her because she should have been president. She was so wise and so, and remember that the democracy, what we think of as democracy in this country, didn't come from arriving Europeans who were imperialists and monarchists. You know, it came from the Native American culture, which really had, from the beginning, and we don't know when the beginning was, invented their own democracy. So the chief, or what we call a chief, might be a man, but he was chosen by the female elders. And it was all about balance with nature, balance with internal power. And this resource is still there. It's still often still there. We can turn to it.
And another friend is Amy Richards. Why is Amy Richards the smartest person you've ever met?
I wish she were here so I could embarrass her. I was writing, I've forgotten which book, and I was just, you know, way overdue. And there was a woman helping me with research who wanted to go to Smith College. And I said, okay, I will help you go to Smith College, get into Smith College, if you replace yourself with somebody else to do the research. And Amy was the person who was still an undergraduate who came in my door and changed my life. You know, she is, I wish she were here so I could embarrass her. She's the smartest person I know. She just, and balanced and, you know, just amazing. Like the great luck of my life. We have chosen families as well as families, right?
When you think about what makes you, you, I heard you once say that if there was a Olympic team for functioning, I'd be a all-star at functioning. You're a lot more than someone who just functions. What is it that makes you tick, if you will? What is it that, I mean, functioning is great, and I love that you'd be a starter on the Olympic functioning team, but there's a lot more to Gloria Steinem that makes you so unique. What is that?
I don't know. Do you think we can see that in ourselves? I don't know exactly. I think I was lucky to grow up first with loving, kind parents who let me be who I was, who always, my mother always said that each baby was, like a person from another planet, and you had to just wait until you could see who they were and you could help them to become who they all already were. That's pretty great for a parent. And you know, this country, Trump to the contrary, is a democracy, and we are able to better able to become ourselves than in many other countries. I mean, I lived in India for 2 years, and I saw a whole different culture. And you know, I can't put together all the happenstance, but whatever it is, I'm so glad that I am at this moment in this room with all of you. We don't know each other, but we kind of think we know each other, right? And I don't know what dreams and wishes and anger is important to, what is in you right at this moment. But whatever it is, because we are together now, it's going to happen. Because we are here supporting each other in that way. We, as human beings, we need to be together. I mean, the reason that solitary confinement is the worst punishment all over the world is because we are communal animals. We need each other. So however it is that you are doing this at this meeting, I say it's fantastic.
If I were smart, I'd end it on that stay right there, but I've got 10 more minutes and I don't want to miss 10 minutes with you. You talk, Gloria, about that sense of link, of being linked to one another. And rather than being right. And talk for a moment about how important that concept of being linked to one another rather than ranked against each other is to you. Because I've heard you talk about it numerous times as something that—
Yes, we embraced, let's say, linked and not ranked. It's just a helpful and I think realistic concept. Because if we are told that we are ranked, then we are constantly obsessed with where we are in the ranking and getting to the next one and so on. We probably are distracted from trying to express what is unique to us and the talents we have and so on. And we are communal animals. I mean, this, you know, as I was saying, the greatest punishment all over the world is a solitary confinement, because we are communal animals.
Where does the women's rights movement go from here?
Wherever it, well, please.
Yeah, but who leads it? I mean, I that speech that Amanda Gorman gave during President Biden's inaugural.
Yes, that was one.
Was just breathtaking. Is it, you know, are eyes on someone like Amanda Gorman to be the person who steps in? Or is there somebody else out there that you see who can take the mantle from you and carry it forward?
I don't have a mantle. I mean, there are folks, here we are, there are people everywhere. Men are feminists too, can and should be. I mean, I think we are struggling, all of us, with gender roles, because then theoretically women are supposed to be more at home taking care of domestic things, children. Men are supposed to be out there earning money. And this is a prison for both men and women. We ought to be able to do what it is that expresses our talents and our needs, and not have these roles handed to us. And I think in a way the pandemic helped a bit, because more men were home with their kids and more men were at home, period. And of course, men love their children too. And, you know, it began to change a little bit, I think, the hierarchy in the home.
Talk about hate and love in the sense that hate specializing and love generalizing. I heard you say that. I thought it was such an impressive way to sort of think about what hate does in our world and what love does in our world.
Yes, I think Robin Morgan, a great poet, is the person who originally said that. But it is true that love specifies, and hate, you have to import a pre-existing idea of the person or the group or something in order to hate. I mean, each of us, as I was saying, each of us in this room is a unique miracle. You could never have happened before in exactly the same way. It could never happen again. And that is so interesting and exciting and precious and helpful in figuring out how we can support each other. Because sometimes we see it in each other when we don't see it in ourselves.
I heard someone ask you, what would you tell your 20-year-old self? And your response to it was, one, it's going to be okay. And second, enjoy it, because you have no idea what's coming next. When I hear you say it's going to be okay, that led me to believe that there were times when you didn't think it was going to be okay.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, when I was in Toledo, my mother and I were living alone. We were living in a house that had once been a family farmhouse, but by then was falling into the huge highway in front of us. My mother was ill. I don't know. I mean, it felt very limited. And it was I was in a state of unrealism that made me think that the answer was that I could dance my way out of Toledo. So I was taking dance. I was never that good, you know.
Did you continue to dance for most of your life?
Yeah, no, I love to dance. But I mean, my dream was to be a rockette.
Really?
Yes, I thought that would get me.
I'm sure someone can get you across the street. It's pretty close to here. Did you ever feel threatened?
I just say that because I think show business is to women what sports is to men in poor neighborhoods. You know, you kind of see it as maybe a way out.
Did you ever feel threatened?
Threatened. Yeah.
When you were an activist, speaking, traveling the world, espousing what you were espousing, did you ever feel either physically threatened or threatened by a counter movement to what you were saying?
Well, not in a personal way, not that it was singling me out, but certainly when I was living in India and I was with a group of people walking from village to village because there had been caste riots. And so this group was trying to tell women and men in villages that actually people cared about them, it was going to be all right, so on. So I could see what people were realistically afraid of, but I could also see that there were people walking village to village saying, no, it's going to be okay, you know, just that there was this instinct. And it's what gave me the understanding of the importance of social justice movements, because I had never seen one in that way until I was living in India. So it made me understand how important the movements were when I came home.
I want to end on an excerpt from the Esquire article that was just written on you a little while ago, where the writer said to you, "I hope you understand the impact that you've had on the world and how much the world has changed because of you." And in typical you, I think we've all seen over the last hour what you are like, you said, I guess I'll have to think about that a little bit. And I find it to be so commendable how not only self-deprecating, but just you are an iconic leader and you have made such an impact on our world. And yet you would sit there with a writer and say, I got to think about whether it actually had an impact.
Well, if we don't know. I mean, every once in a while, I go outside my door. The guy who delivers the mail is there. He turns out to be the political leader of Queens. We organize something, you know, I mean, it has to do with the moment, the person, the results that you see. It's enormously touching. And, you know, maybe we should meet again next year and we can all tell each other what, if anything, changed, because we were here together today, or if you maybe gained confidence to do something he wanted to do, or thought of, oh no, we want another speaker, a different speaker next year.
We'll take you back in a second, Gloria. Let me just tell you that. Honestly, it's a true pleasure. And on behalf of everyone in the room, thank you so much for joining us.
No, I thank you.